feel. Do what you want.
Friends, welcome to Beyond the Break. That song that you just heard is called Do What You Wanna by the Rebirth Brass Band from New Orleans, Louisiana. You may have heard me mention in a couple previous episodes that I was moving across the country to California for a job opportunity and also to pursue music and whatever path that takes me in life. So I got this job as a naturalist at an outdoor education school here in Ojai, California, which is about an hour and a half north of Los Angeles. It's in Ventura County. It's a beautiful place, which I'm enjoying. But I wanted to talk a little bit about my journey across. Originally, I had planned to record episodes as I went with the people that I met, which I met some incredible people. However, I was too busy just living, honestly, just getting out there and exploring these places, recording and editing these podcasts with the upload, just producing them takes at least a few hours. And I honestly didn't feel like I had that to spare because each place that I stopped was so incredible, really, and impactful on me. And I just really wanted to get out and see them. And I had many great conversations with some very fascinating people, but this conversation that you're about to hear is the only one that I actually got a chance to sit down and record. So New Orleans was my first stop. I have a good buddy down there Well, he's from there, but he actually, I grew up with him for a good part of our childhood and then growing into adulthood, where I'm from in Massachusetts, my hometown of Plymouth. His name is Austin. And he has an uncle that lives down there in New Orleans, right outside the French Quarter. And so he and I made the first leg of the road trip down to New Orleans from Massachusetts. And New Orleans was a really incredible place, and it's a place that's left a far bigger impact on me than I think I could have imagined. I'm just going to read you a few notes from my journal on it, which kind of give you a feel for it, or at least my impression of the place. And it will hopefully illuminate kind of what it's like to be there, but I highly recommend going and seeing it for yourself. New Orleans is a place unlike any other. The very air here is heavy, heavy with the low elevation, laden with sense, music, and soul. A place where Americans let loose and where anything is possible. Laissez-faire, controlled and sometimes uncontrolled chaos. Not entirely safe, but with a wanton friendliness that puts one at ease. There are people sleeping on the street with concrete as their pillows. There are drunks, junkies, cripples, pirates, beautiful ladies and prostitutes. The people are open and friendly. Everyone has something to sell, something to offer, in many cases themselves. Music emanating from everywhere. The streets lined with palms and majestic live oaks. The possibility and depravity. Noah already has a special spot in my heart. I am glad it exists, and I hope it continues to. So yeah, I mean, that's what it's like. There's every type of person down there. It's where a lot of America comes to let loose and party, like I just said. And so there's people from all walks of life. There's people that never leave. And people that come from everywhere. So, it really is a special place. I think it exudes a certain type of spiritual energy, just natively, but a lot of it is just how much history has gone down there, how many really creative people have lived there, the whole history of the city. I mean, it's a really unique place, that's for sure. And the vibe with those big live oaks, which I'd never seen before, with the Spanish moss hanging down and that heavy air. And then you walk out at night and there's these, at least when I was there, there were these night blooming flowers, night blooming jasmine, my buddy's uncle, Zach, told me. And it's beautiful. But then you walk another few feet and you smell like shit and piss. So, you know, it's a city of possibility where anything can happen. Lots of amazingly good things, but also some bad things could probably happen to you there. So it's a really enchanting place, and it's a place that I definitely am going to be returning to for the rest of my life, I feel like. So that band, the Rebirth Brass Band, there's an interesting little story that I have with the band, because before I left, a good buddy of mine who has spent the past couple winter seasons fishing, commercial fishing down in the Florida Keys, said to me, moving to a new place is like being reborn. And that has really rung true for this whole process of like my conception in New England, and then moving through the birth canal of the middle of America, and then emerging freshly reborn on the opposite shore, which is what I have done. And I've definitely been changed as a person by the things I saw, the people I met, the experiences I had. And seeing this band was one of them. On the second night I was in New Orleans, I was able to go and see this band at a really historic little venue called the Maple Leaf Bar. And, you know, they had free red beans and rice after the show. That type of place, great, great people, and a great band. And seeing this music, it's so soulful and so joyful. And I mean, this recording is nothing, you know, seeing it live is just incredible. With that full force of the brass just hitting you and the drums, it really is like cathartic, and it makes you a new person. It's just got so much feeling in it. And the players, you can really get a sense for each of their personalities, especially in a live show where they're doing a lot more improvisation and soloing. They're just something else. And I believe they have a Tiny Desk concert as well. I think I've heard that. I would definitely check it out. I actually haven't seen it, but I'm planning on watching it very soon. But anyways, I hope whoever you are out there that you're doing well. The conversation that you're about to hear is from a part of my trip when I went to California, or I got into California, and I stayed at a place near Joshua Tree with this man named Tal Ruspoli, who you will hear is a very fascinating person. He's a musician, director, filmmaker, producer, writer, I'm sure. He does everything. He's also an Italian prince, as a side note. You know, he's a pretty fascinating person, and staying at his place was a great experience. I mean, it's an incredible little Airbnb business that he runs out in the desert near Joshua Tree. It's beautiful property. He's got all these amazing little campers that he's converted into tiny homes, you know, like Airstreams and different things like that. One of them is a boat that I saw. He's got another bus. Like, it's incredible. And he has all these really creative, artistic people just cycling through who I got to meet when I was there. I just parked my van there. He had posted on Instagram if anyone wanted to come jam in the desert, to hit him up in the DMs. So I did, and I came out and was able to park my van there for a very nominal fee, use his beautiful pool and hot tub that he has out there in the desert, meet the incredible guests and himself, and I got to jam with him and record this podcast. So it was a really beautiful experience, beautiful people there. And this conversation I really enjoyed, and I hope that you do too. The song that you're about to hear is called Jacob's Piano, or actually, sorry, it's Mariage d'Amour. It's French for something of love. I'm going to guess marriage. I know d'amour is love. Maybe it's not marriage, but it's an incredibly beautiful song, and Tao was practicing this on his grand piano most mornings and just at different random intervals during the day when I would be out around the property hanging out. And it was this kind of backtrack, you know, soundtrack to my experience there, which was definitely very changing and really beautiful, just like the music. So this is a recording off of YouTube. You can find it there. Just look up Mariage d'Amour, Jacob's Piano. I wish that I had gotten a good recording of Tao playing it, because that's even more special. But it's a really beautiful song. Thank you. this has been an amazing few days here. This spot that you've assembled here in the desert, both like the setting and the people are just so incredible. And it's been incredibly inspiring to be around you, as the artist that you are, but also all the lovely human beings that you've assembled here.
Yeah, I never thought I would live in the middle of nowhere. And when I first got this place, I kind of ended up here by accident because I had this Airbnb in Venice Beach. I was renting trailers in my backyard, and I came home one summer with like 4 pages of code violations and an ultimatum of like 30 days to move the trailers. And I tried to say to the inspector, like, I just collect trailers. And he's like, no, I just met two of your Airbnb guests. And I'd found that this was a really good little kind of intersection of things that I love, from architecture and design to community building to, you know, airstreams and nomadic living. And I always had this kind of background dream of owning a trailer park. I don't know why, but I've always loved this kind of Americana, especially in the vintage flavor of it, of, you know, like old trailers from the 50s and 60s. I mean, I think we all appreciate that now. But anyway, I got this little piece of land in Joshua Tree ostensibly just to move my trailers to. And then I it was so beautiful. And I just thought, okay, well, maybe I'll spend a month here just to set it up. And, you know, 3 years passed and I realized I didn't miss LA at all. But the first time I came up here with a dear friend of mine, Mark Rathel, who's a professor of philosophy at Oxford, very dear friend and interesting, wise person. And he came up here and he looked very concerned and worried. And he had this like long look on his face, like, and I was like, what's wrong? You don't like it? And he's like, Tao, I can't imagine you up here in the middle of nowhere, you know, isolated. And, you know, you're such a social person. And little did he know, or I know really, that I would have a more active social life here than I ever had in the city, and a much more interesting one, because I have a constant stream of great visitors, including you. And people just show up here for all different reasons. I just had old friend of my mother's who I hadn't seen in years called me and say she needed a place to come write. And then when you hang out with people here, you really commune with them. It's not like in the city where you're looking at your watch and have somewhere to be in 30 minutes and, you know, you might have lunch, but you really feel like you've just scratched the surface. Whereas here you have like several days with somebody, and the intersection of Airbnb plus friends plus friends of friends, it causes a real sense of community, as you've seen. And it's 1,000 times more interesting than anything I've experienced in any city.
Yeah, I couldn't have said it better myself. I mean, you just summed it up right there. I just, in the few days that I've been here, I've made friends that I genuinely think are going to last, you know, and moving forward.
Now, I have to remind myself that some of my dearest friends were once Airbnb guests. It's so weird. Like, and then people say, like, how can you let strangers into your home? And I'm like, they're only strangers for a few minutes. And then... you know, especially in this environment, you very quickly become, and it's a self-selecting group, you know, like I've done what I don't want to be still. Some people like approve their guests on, you know, that by looking at them or trying to figure something out about them. I don't do that. But what I try and do is I describe the place in such a way that will only attract the types of people that I think are open-minded enough to really go with the flow. And it's very rare it's a self-selecting group. I don't get like, people who are unpleasant to be around.
Yeah,
I mean, I like most people, so I'm lucky in that way. But it's literally 90% of the people who show up here, like I want to have dinner with, you know. So that's really lucky.
Right. So I already know a little bit about your life from just hearing you speak on other podcasts. Like, I love tangentially speaking, and that's why I was telling you where I first heard about you. I know you've had like an incredibly diverse life and career, but can you just go back and maybe give a, I know it's hard to sum it up, but maybe go back and talk about your childhood a little bit and what that was like growing up and how you kind of got to this space.
Yeah, well, I could probably ramble on for an hour about this. I'll try to keep it. I'll give you the main highlights, I guess, because I've been lucky enough to be born into a very eclectic and just unique situation or situations. My father was a opium smoking Italian eccentric prince, and he loved the Far East, And he spent many years in Laos and Thailand, and he was a very rebellious and wonderful, exuberant, eccentric character, and born in 1924. And he met my mother, who was a young hippie traveler, searcher, seeker, artist, whose father had come to Italy, actually, and who was a big inspiration to me. Her father was an American actor who moved to Italy and became a spaghetti Western star. And he lived like on the Amalfi Coast in a commune, and he took all the locks off the doors and allowed anybody to come in. And so that was probably planted the seed in me for this sort of life that I'm creating. But my mother ran away from home when she was like 15 to find her father, her estranged father in Italy, and then met my father. And when she was 18, they went to Thailand, and I was born. My dad was 50, and his wife still lived upstairs with my older brother. And we moved back to Rome after a few months. So I don't remember Thailand at that time, but I did grow up the first 8 years in Italy with both my parents in this kind of unusual setup. And they had another child, my little brother. And then when I was 8 years old, my parents split up and I moved to California with my mom. And I had this kind of double life, which was a very normal middle class life in California during the school year. And then summer times, go to Italy and hang out with my dad in the family castle, which has been in our family since 1531. And it was a good kind of mixture of like the sense of both the sense of kind of quasi-normalcy and of infinite possibility that I think American culture has at its best. And then, because it's something, even with my dad's really kind of non-conformist lifestyle, it was still, Italian culture is still very deeply conservative, I think, and doesn't have the sense that you can do anything in life. The moment you have an idea, there'll be 10 people telling you why you can't do it.
Mm.
So I think what I learned here in America was like, you can create, it's more of a blank canvas, let's say. So anyway, I grew up in LA and Italy, and then I went to UC Berkeley, and I thought I wanted to study architecture because I thought it was going to be in something I still love, a good intersection of something creative but also serious, quote unquote. But then I took a class at Berkeley called Existentialism in Literature and Film, and it changed my life because this professor, Hubert Dreyfus, who became my mentor, my first of many mentors in life, maybe not the first, but early mentor, he was interested in existentialist philosophies, particularly in the work of Martin Heidegger and Dostoevsky and Nietzsche and Kierkegaard. And he was interested in how these philosophies were not best suited to theoretical kind of philosophical, traditional American philosophical approaches, and that they could be better explored in media like literature and film. So I always had loved philosophy, but I never wanted to be an academic. So this kind of opened a door to the idea that I could be a philosopher in the medium of film and photography and life, let's say, you know, life creation, community building and all of this. So I studied for 5.5 years, pretty much. I mean, I took all the necessary requisite courses at Berkeley, but Dreyfus was my kind of mentor and person I kind of studied under in a kind of traditional way that you used to like study under a master or something. In fact, I went back like years later and made a documentary exploring the implications of his work called Being in the World. And that's one of my favorite films that I've made. Anyway, so I finished Berkeley I took a break in 98. I went to Seville and continued my study of flamenco, which was a big passion of mine for many years. Made another film there called Flamenco, A Personal Journey, and really got to know that whole way of life of the gypsies and flamenco is really deeply influenced my way of seeing the world and art, and also kind of blurring the line between life and art. And then I finished Berkeley, and I bought an old school bus on eBay, and we outfitted it with digital video at the time, this is like 2001, it was kind of a new idea that you could make a film without like the expense and the infrastructure of Hollywood. And so we had this thing called the Los Angeles Filmmakers Cooperative. We were based out of this bus that I tore out all the seats and I put editing systems inside of it and kind of first realized my passion for the intersection between art, nomadism, and technology. And I'd never heard of Burning Man at the time, but a friend told me about it. And we took the bus there in 2001. And suddenly I looked around and saw like 25,000 like-minded individuals, all of whom were interested in kind of pursuing. Now I think it seems a little cliche. I think it's kind of played out a little bit. But at the time it seemed really, or it's been co-opted, let's say, by capitalism, as often happens. But at the time it really felt like you were on the edge of something really interesting, of people like kind of not like exalting imagination and community and technology and art, and not, and maybe putting like, and also experimenting with new ways of kind of dealing with the environment and kind of inhabiting this post-apocalyptic space of this like lunar nothingness, and seeing like what emerges. And what emerged seemed to be a really positive iteration of mankind. And so that was a huge inspiration at the time. And we traveled around in the bus for many years. And then I met a girl while I was living in the bus, and we got married in the bus. And she was like an intern working in a casting office. And then we had this really unique experience of watching somebody get propelled into stardom because she was an actress. And so that was, 8 years of my life there in Venice Beach, and kind of like living this interesting chapter of life. And that ended in 2011. And then I got really involved in Bombay Beach and the Salton Sea, made some more films, Monogamish, started this festival called the Bombay Beach Biennale with a few friends. And now here we are in the desert. That's the recap, I guess.
Wow. Well, great job for summing it up and so succinctly. I mean, I think you really hit on the main points very well. And I mean, there's so much to dive into in that. But one thing, part of your work that's really connected with me is that documentary you made, or film, Flamenco, A Personal Journey. Because I'm a musician myself. And to see that culture... because it really is, it's more than a music. It like you were saying, it's like a culture, it's a way of life. And to see like how deeply the music is kind of interwoven with that is so cool. And it's taught me a lot about just, I think, art by an extension. You know, one of the main points, if I'm remembering correctly from the film, is, you know, flamenco isn't necessarily something that gets performed on a stage
once it is, you're losing a lot of it. Yeah.
Right. The best flamenco happens after, you know, you've been drinking all night and it's the wee hours of the morning and you're sitting around the bar and it's just this like pure expression. And it was, I mean, you really did a very unique thing in capturing on film and audio those moments, because those are so special and so exclusive.
It was so funny because a lot of the old flamencos were saying, oh, flamenco's dead, and like, you know, you're just getting the remnants. And I knew that in part this was true because it was on this trajectory of death. But I think it, in a way, it always was. And I could feel deeply that I was living a historic moment that 20 years later would be seen as, you know, historic archival material that was as interesting, would be as interesting in 20 years as the footage was to us from the 1960s and 70s that we would dig up. And at the time there was no YouTube or anything. So like you'd people would make copies of VHS tapes and show each other like these gems of flamenco, which wasn't we talked about the positive side of American life, which is that anything's possible. I think the negative side is that everything is commodified and everything is only validated or valued if it can be commodified. And you know, we only we often only will take somebody seriously in a field if they like make a living from it. Whereas in the flamenco world, it's the opposite. I remember reading the CD liner notes of this very famous flamenco family, and they all worked as butchers. And the interviewer in this, you know, little brief interview inside the CD said, like, well, why do you still work as butchers when you could so easily make your living with your flamenco? And they said, well, only the most desperate person who didn't know how to do anything else would like resort to selling their art. And that's just very weird to American ears. I mean, we understand it maybe with sex, right? Like, mm-hmm. They say like sex and writing are the two things that are not as much fun if you're doing them for money. And but with everything else, it seems like we have this thing, like it needs to be built to be packaged and sold. And if not, you're not probably that good at it. Whereas in the flamenco world, like, I was so lucky that the cameras had gotten so small, and I made friends with a 78-year-old like singer who had like 3 teeth on the left side and 2 teeth on the bottom right. And he would like take me out, and he'd go into the bathroom and like snort cocaine and like stay up till like 10 in the morning. It was just so wild. And then he was like, there's a very much a respect for the older people there. And so he, you know, I'd pull out the camera and people would say like, no filming. And he'd say, no, it's for me. It's okay. And that's how a lot of the filming happened. And I had the kind of patience and enthusiasm to like hang out until 5. Sometimes you just have to sit with these guys in a bar, like smoking cigarettes and drinking until like 5 in the morning, until somebody would actually like pull out a guitar, or I'd bring a guitar with me in the hope and kind of leave it in a conspicuous place, knowing that it would inspire somebody. Cause for them, it was so deeply rooted in them. And some nights it would happen, some it wouldn't. And when it did, it was always marvelous. But it wasn't something that you could just call up and just say, perform for me. And the moment that they would do that, 90% of it was lost. When you put it on the stage and it wasn't this kind of cohesive, focal experience, which I explored more deeply, I think, the theory behind it in Being in the World. So Heidegger had this idea that... skillfulness was a way to gather people in a unique way and create a more meaningful life. And so the best example of this is music. So if you think of before the advent of iPhones and iPods and everything, if you wanted to hear music, or let's say before the advent of recorded music, if you wanted to hear music, you had to learn to play an instrument. And then you would, you know, let's say you played the violin, that would individuate you as different from the ones who didn't play any music at all, and even from the people who did play different instruments. And so you would become a meaningfully different individual, and so would the other people you play music with. And then you would meet in a particular place, which maybe like was determined by the acoustics of the room, and like or a place that you could, you know, play and gather with other people and, you know, eat and drink and do all of these things that kind of gather people together. And then it would be a particular time, right? So you would, you know, meet on Thursdays at 8 o'clock, and then that time acquired significance. And if you compare that to, you know, Spotify, where it doesn't matter who you are, you just can push the button. It doesn't require any particular skill or background or anything. And it doesn't matter who you're with. In fact, it separates you from whoever you're with, usually, if you're wearing headphones. And then it doesn't matter where you are, and it doesn't matter when it is. So the time, the place, and the person become meaningless, literally, because it just doesn't matter. So the idea was that we need to cultivate skillful practices. And it also, obviously, you know, if you play music, it structures your day in the way of like practicing how important it is, and you lose it. So there's this kind of temporal aspect. Obviously, music itself exists in time. And we associate so much like times that we would listen to a particular piece of music and how much it touches us. And the good news is that we have we resist the technology naturally and kind of keep taking it on skillfully. The example I like for that is like, the record was made to like passively listen to, but then people started becoming DJs and started scratching the record and using the record as an instrument and developing a skill with that. So there is this always back and forth between like the technology, which like obviates the need for skill and community and significance and the human deep need for continuing that. And it's interesting, this happening also now with, I heard somebody saying the other day, we have like a short attention span of 5 seconds, except we also have this 3-hour attention span and people are listening to these podcasts and really engaging with people in a meaningful way. And so I spent a lot of time thinking about these issues.
Yeah, and they're very interesting to think about. And you know, I think there's a lot of good points there, especially about, you know, music is by nature fleeting. It's something that occurs in time, and it's something that is it can be very personal, and I think it should be very personal. That I like bands that not only are playing for the audience, but the audience is playing them.
Yeah,
you know, absolutely. As there's actually one of my favorite bands is the Grateful Dead, and they were very about feeding off the vibrations of the audience. You know, actually, there's one of the lyrics in their song that says, "As the music plays, the band." You know, because they're really kind of it's about surrendering to that sound instead of trying to like put something out, but surrendering and feeding off those vibes and making something that is unique in that moment and won't happen again. And that's why, you know, I was just talking with Sarah this morning about the live records, you know, that they have all the different shows. They never played a song the same way twice because it depended on how they were feeling and how the audience was feeling. And that interplay is so important. Another point that you hit on a little bit, like the age thing, with the flamenco, going back to that, I thought it was really interesting. I think there was one point, in the film where they were saying that, young men haven't experienced enough life to really be a good flamenco musician. You know, it's the old men that have lived life and had the experiences that are the most soulful and have the best ability. And I think that's an interesting and great way to look at age, you know, because especially in our American culture, age is something that's so kind of like
fetishized.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Christopher Ryan actually said that in a recent podcast that I was listening to of his, where he said, we're selling this idea that like youth is what we all want. And really, if you think about it, I mean, you're still very young, but like life does just get better, I think. And the way Chris says it is that, you know, people underestimate the anxiety that comes with having your life in front of you, and wondering what is, you know, going to be expected of you and how much choice do you have in directing it the way you imagine. And whereas after you've lived for a while, you get this, the way he said it, they can't steal money you've already spent. So you have this luxury of looking back and also of recreating your life over and over again in different narratives. It's interesting. I was listening the other day to another conversation about how we choose what we do, like on a vacation, for example, partly on what the intrinsic feeling will be of doing that, and partly on how we will recount to our friends and to ourselves what we did. So even if the things themselves aren't quite as pleasurable, say just you wanted to, and if you ask somebody, okay, you can have a vacation for a month, but at the end of it, we're going to erase all your memories of it. And you won't be able to have any pictures or any mementos from it. People will choose a different vacation than if they're going to get to like have that for the rest of their lives.
Yeah. And in our age of social media and having our phones always able to record moments, I noticed that myself. This cross-country
almost too
trip.
Much. Yeah, it's
interesting. Yeah, it is. I've noticed on this cross-country trip, I've had that dilemma where I've seen these amazing sights and I feel this like compulsion to pull my phone out and take a picture of it, you know, so I can share it or so I can look back on it later. But yeah. I have to keep reminding myself, no, what matters is me experiencing this in the moment fully. And recording things is great. You know, taking pictures is great. Making this recording, this conversation is great. Recording music is great. But what's really important is what's happening there in the moment. And it can take you away from that, like from being fully absorbed in that if you're like trying to capture it at the same time.
Yeah. But or maybe it's both. Like we wouldn't be having this conversation if we weren't capturing it.
Right.
So it also can like open up. There was this in documentary filmmaking, there was this kind of ideal in the 60s of cinema verite and the idea of like you could maybe have a, you know, fly on the wall, like capturing life caught unawares. And then I think people realized that was a pipe dream, right? And that, I don't remember who it was. It was like a French filmmaker in the 70s, famous French documentary filmmaker. His name is escaping me right now. But he said, no, we should actually see the camera as a catalyst for truth and acknowledge its presence and stuff like that. And I think that's what's happening now. For example, if you said, let's go just sit in a room and just talk for an hour, I'd be like, yeah, no. but that this is allowing like this deeper conversation to happen. And maybe we should, you know, this whole like live in the moment thing is a little too facile and cliche, I think. Like be here now and everything, as much as I like Leary and Ram Dass and everything. But I think in my kind of study of philosophy and temporality and kind of little more nuanced view of it, I hope, that acknowledges that we are always pressing forward into a future of possibilities, and we're always also taking into account what we've come from. And human being is like this unique relationship to past, present, and future. And of course there's a wonderful feeling of being absorbed in a moment. But even if you're a great musician and you're playing, you're still in every note carrying all those experiences that you've had and all those hours that you've practiced. And even if someone's just playing one note, like B.B. King or something, and he's just bending one note, there's no fucking way that you're going to do that without the life that he's lived and the hours that he's played and the people that he's played with. And you can hear that in a single note. So it's this really interesting presence in that moment of the past, of that moment, which is impactful, but also the of anticipation of like, what's he going to do next? And I don't think we should get rid of those distinctions and those differences. They're really interesting. And they're maybe what makes us uniquely human, right? Compared to other animals or something.
Indeed. Yeah. That's a really good point. And that's a good way to think of it. And I think also, you know, the act of recording your experiences, for posterity is not something that's like inherently selfish or wrong. I think it's a good thing, you know, to say, oh, I lived a life, I did something, I created something, and even after I'm gone, this thing will still be around. You know, who knows what's going to happen to whatever server that this thing is kept on that we're recording now, right? But I'd like to think that sometime in the future, after we're both gone, you know, people could still listen to it if they wanted to. And yeah, I like that idea.
And yeah, so on the one hand, we're documenting so much in this age, but on the other hand, there's the possibility that in 1,000 years they're going to see this as the kind of dark ages, because all of the media that we're putting this on is so ephemeral. So a typical hard drive will not last more than 3 years. And we still haven't come up with a more durable way of like storing all this digital technology. All we can hope is that people back things up, which is a kind of slender reed to like hang your hopes on. I'm hoping that as an obsessive kind of archivist and documentarian, I do hope that we come up with some way of like, you know, creating some more solid artifacts of all the stuff that we're making.
Yeah. Another thing I wanted to touch on is your film Monogamish. I'd like you to just explain a bit about how you arrived at the idea to make it, like what was the inspiration, and maybe talk a little bit about the underlying like ideas and philosophies that kind of underlie that.
Oh, absolutely. Like I kind of had gone down the traditional monogamy marriage route. I think it was partly a reaction to the uncertainty that I grew up with, of having like parents who'd never gotten married and had, you know, so many different experiences. You know, children kind of long for some stability and some predictability. And and Esther Perel, who's in the film and is wonderful, she says like we're living this paradox all the time, and you can see it in a child already. Like on the one hand, they want the safety and security of being with their parents, and on the other hand, they want to venture out into the world and see what's out there. And so there's always this kind of deep, unresolvable tension between our desires for security and safety and predictability on the one hand, you know, the unknown and the mystery and eroticism on the other. And so I had chosen the path of the former, of like wanting, and I often had really, you know, same girlfriend in high school and college, and then always long, long relationships that kind of provided this sense of stability that maybe unconsciously I thought I needed because I hadn't had it growing up. And then as I got older, well, then, you know, my marriage ended, and I suddenly was like sent into a tailspin and needing to ask these questions. And as we were discussing, like the act of documenting can also be a meaningful process, and it's in and of itself an act of discovery. So I naturally picked up a camera and like started asking questions as a way of dealing with my heartache. And the first person I met was this 75-year-old woman who was amazing. She had like a 40-year-old boyfriend and was really frank about her conversations about sex and relationships. And she'd become a kind of an official advisor, therapist to me in my time of getting divorced. And so I made a short film about her. And then my friend and mentor, Oliver Stone, saw the short film I made on her. And he's like, oh, this is really solid. You should like expand this. And I, you know, having just made a film about Heidegger and philosophy and, you know, obscure flamenco and stuff like this, I was a little bit snobby about like, oh, relationships. It seemed like kind of like a flaky subject. But then I realized how quickly I realized that I was gravely mistaken about that. I mean, you can attack this issue from like any number of angles, whether it's a anthropological, the way Christopher Ryan does, or social, political, psychological, economic. I mean, there's just, you could pick any attack on this subject would be the subject for, you know, would be like fodder for 10 PhD dissertations. And so I quickly found this out, and I started interviewing people, lawyers and, you know, anthropologists and sex therapists and sex workers, and just trying to understand like, why does marriage exist as an institution? Why does monogamy exist as an ideal? And how does this kind of all of these considerations fit in this uneasy kind of institution that we've called marriage that keeps evolving and keeps changing, but at the same time it's still there from thousands of years and steeped in patriarchy and sexual mores that we always think are like the way we're living them now are the natural ones. And even though all we have to do is look back 20 years or like look over a couple of countries and see that they're changing all the time and everywhere. So anyway, I that's how I met Chris Ryan. He wrote Sex at Dawn. And so we interviewed him and Dan Savage and Esther Perel and like all these just wonderful luminaries and interesting, articulate people who had thought about this their whole lives. And the amazing thing was that this affects everybody. Even if you're a hermit, you know, living in the mountains, you still had parents and like, you know, how they raised you and how they were relating to each other, you know, is part of what makes you who you are. So I just, and it was interesting because I couldn't finish the film until I kind of worked out some of these things myself personally. So I thought after a year I'd finished the film and I showed it to a few people and I was all excited. And then I could feel the room just like, it just wasn't working. And at the end of it, even my own mother, who should be your most like, you know, biggest fan, was like, no, this isn't working at all. You know, keep trying. And it took me 4 years and kind of entering my first polyamorous relationship and realizing that it was time for me to explore a different way of pursuing relationships. And, you know, it's a constant challenge and it's a constant ongoing conversation. And I like the movie now, and I hope that people can learn something from it. It doesn't try and advocate for any particular answer, but it does, I think, give good tools for discussing these things and for thinking about them in a more deep and nuanced way, an honest way, hopefully.
Mm. And why is it, do you think, that this subject in particular seems to incite in some groups of people like such adversity and such like kind of lashback?
Well, it's funny, like I was listening to one of my favorite podcasts, Lex Friedman, who does this artificial intelligence podcast.
I've heard of
MIT,
that one.
And he interviewed Krugman yesterday, and he said, look, I don't usually delve into political things, and I know that he's a controversial figure for some people, and some of you are going to just dislike it before you even listen to it. So if you do, please just unsubscribe from my podcast, because this is this domain, which he says I studiously avoid, is rife with people who for some reason have more certainty in it than anything else in their lives, even though it's the domain in which the answers are the most uncertain, and we don't know what the right answers are, and maybe we should just open our minds, right? And so it seems like politics and sexuality and morality and religion and all of these things are places where they have such an effect on our lives and such a real effect. It's not it's not theoretical, right? It's like I said, how people make these choices is going to affect what makes you who you are. So I think people are right to put a lot of weight on it, right? I mean, political issues and sexual issues, like, they have import. Like, it matters. There's a difference. Like, if how these things pan out, people's lives are at stake, literally. So I think that's why people get very emotional about it. And I don't think you're gonna stop that. You can't be. That was the problem with the early cuts of my movie. They were too theoretical and too cold. And then when I realized that I had to put my heart into it, and I had to have like show the stakes that it had, and I couldn't just have a bunch of academics talking about like the history of marriage and stuff. Only then was I able to make something like that could touch people, right? So I don't knock people for taking these things seriously, but you do hope that people can open their minds enough to engage meaningfully with different possibilities, let's say.
Right, and it's apparent that the current system, you know, it works for some people, but for a large number of people, you know, the current system in our society of monogamy, of marriage, doesn't really work. You know, I know lots of people that have been divorced, people that haven't been, that are in unhappy marriages. I think it's interesting how you mentioned that you're, you know, because of your kind of childhood, how you kind of sought stability. My parents weren't married either, and I was raised by my grandmother, single grandparent, and I remember in a different way when I was a kid, I would kind of like latch on to like my friends' families, you know, because yep. Like I was just, you know, it was my grandmother and I, and she did a wonderful job of raising me, but to like have that stability of like a whole family unit with a mom and dad, brothers and sisters, you know, like aunts and uncles coming over, and like that whole thing like was really appealing to me. And I would spend like a lot of time with those families, and they'd like have me over to dinner and stuff. And I did kind of like latch onto that. But as I've gotten older, I've realized that there is a lot to be said for that kind of stability. But I also, by being raised by my grandmother and having the unique childhood situation that I had, I also was exposed to some things and learned a lot of things that I wouldn't have otherwise. Yeah. And similarly in my relationships, same thing. I I'm still quite young, but you know, when I was even younger than I am now, you know, I was someone who definitely kind of latched onto the stability. I was more of, you know, someone who was kind of the idea like, oh, I'm going to meet that person, and it's about that person, and it's going to be forever, and all that stuff, which I guess most of us are kind of like when we're young. But I think that was maybe influenced by my childhood situation. And then, you know, same thing as with my family situation, with my relationships, as I've gotten older, I've been exposed, you know, through the work of you and people like Chris Ryan and others, been exposed to this like different idea of relationship. And I myself have experienced a polyamorous relationship, and, you know, it was a tremendous learning and growing experience for me. And, you know, I can't advocate it for everyone. But I know like for me, and especially moving forward in my life with future relationships, it's something that I really bring into consideration.
Yeah. And you know, the this is the last thing I'll say, because I think we need to stop soon.
But, of course.
Looking at it from a larger picture, we have this, you know, like people will say the most complex thing in the universe is a human brain, right? Because we have this way of you know, individuating humans as these like distinct entities. And I've always thought like, well, that's absurd, because like this room is more complex than a brain. It contains two brains, and you're more complex than a brain because you have a brain. And so maybe, and we think like, you know, consciousness is a, and it's a issue, a philosophical issue that I spent a lot of time thinking about, conscious awareness maybe emerges from complexity. And the only complexity that we can recognize is like when it looks a little bit like ours, right? So I can see you have eyes and a nose and an ears. And so you probably are experiencing something like I do, but we don't know what it's like to be this room right now, because we just wouldn't know how to see that. But I think seeing larger or like organization of humans, and like thinking of a city as an entity or a country as an entity, and like which makes decisions and like, you know, goes to war or does, you know, different confronts the reality outside of itself in interesting ways. So maybe this idea of like conservative and progressive, the optimist in me wants to think like they're just two forces that are necessary for society to go forward, that there has to be this push pull always. And I think we're living in a really interesting time right now, because we're kind of acknowledging that we can explore these things in a more nuanced way. So in the 60s, in the time of my grandfather and Timothy Leary and stuff, like that, people took psychedelics for the first time and in the 50s and 60s, and suddenly they're like, oh, all of Western civilization, it's all a sham, it's all an illusion, let's throw it all out the window. And if you listen to like interviews with Timothy Leary today from like 19 or talks that he gave in 1965, it's shocking how he would say like, okay, everyone should quit their jobs, everyone should drop out of school, no one over 40 should be allowed to vote, like all, you know, kind of institutions should be smashed. And that didn't work. And so like now with like sexuality, with psychedelics, with relationships, with we're kind of trying to, I think there's this kind of more careful and nuanced exploration happening, and hopefully people are opening their mind to like we talked about, like the needs of some sense of stability and predictability. And so that's why I think polyamory is really interesting. Like people can hopefully explore the newness and the eroticism of new experiences and the unknown, while at the same time acknowledging the desire and the need for ongoing stable relationships. And so anyway, I'm conflating a lot of different issues here, but
that's my alarm for having to go
get my hair cut, unfortunately. But I think we've touched on a lot of interesting things.
Definitely.
And if people want to see the films that we've talked about, Being in the World, Monogamish, those two are on Amazon Prime. And the Flamenco Personal Journeys on YouTube. I have a lot of, you know, dozens of short subject stuff on YouTube that people can check out. Just searching Tao Ruspolian. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Tao. All right, friends, that's it for this week, and potentially given my track record for the next month. But hopefully I will get a chance to record now that I'm starting to settle down and be off the road a bit. California is a beautiful place. The weather, the landscapes, the mountains, and the sea coming together. I'm really enjoying it, and I'm enjoying the nature as well as the people, the artistic opportunities, the inspiration. It's a pretty fantastic place. My job is inspiring. I'm working as a naturalist, being forced to really get out in nature every day and explain it to these kids, keep them interested, and get a chance to hopefully pass some kind of environmental awareness, or at least just passion for the outdoors, down to a younger generation, because being in nature has given me so much, in my life, and continues to, and it really is very rewarding. So all in all, it's been a great experience being out here, and I look forward to sharing more of my experiences and hopefully some conversations with some of the folks that I met out here. I'm going to play you out with a song by the Barrett Martin Group. It's called Play the Fourth Prime, and it's delightful. And the whole album that this is on is just rad. It's called Transcendence, and it's something that I've just been really vibing with recently. So I hope you enjoy. Hare Krishna.